This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Girl Logic, written and performed by Eliza Schlesinger. Foreword written and performed by Mayim Bialik.
Foreword by Mayim Bialik. It's hard to know where to begin when you talk about Eliza Schlesinger. It's hard to describe her. It's harder still to be the woman writing a foreword in a book written by Eliza Schlesinger. Let's start with what we see on the outside. As a character actress who has struggled with my appearance and others' judgments about my appearance since I was 9 years old, I know that Eliza is a stunner. It doesn't take but a glance to see it. Her eyes, her cheekbones, her skin, her lips, and that sweet nose. She's pretty and cute and gorgeous all at once. Her body is fiercely strong and sexy, and her clothing choices on and off stage convey a confidence and an eccentricity that is enviable. She isn't afraid to be called hot, because she totally is. But the outside of Eliza is not the only way I think or talk about her. And it's no longer even one of the first things I think about. Eliza is a comedian, a philosopher, a performer, and a business force to be reckoned with. She is a girl with logic that defies logic, and she is a woman who breaks rules I didn't even know existed. Eliza is devoted and loving and kind, and she is generous and tender and protective. That's who she is, and that's what she brings to life. What struck me most about Eliza when I first found her on a weepy, lonely night in my living room, I had recently had a breakup from a significantly fantastic man I was still in love with, was that she was smart as a whip. She possesses a wisdom and a self-reflection that is rarely seen in any comedian, and I certainly was not used to a female comedian speaking the way she does and breaking the universe down the way she does. Eliza is a fearless comedian because she is a fearless woman. Her brain does not work the way your brain or mine works, and you can trust me on this. I'm a doctor. Eliza's brain doesn't just see a thing. She sees all the things that made the thing the thing. And she simultaneously sees all the reasons the thing should be something else, but isn't. And she simultaneously sees the ways the thing could be better, and she manages to communicate incredibly clearly and directly everything you need to know, and some things you may not need to know, about that thing. She sees deeply, she thinks deeply, and she feels deeply. She leaves no stone unturned, ever. It would be enough in the world of comedy if Eliza Schlesinger simply did what she does so well once. If she told one joke or one story with her wisdom and her insight and her skill, it would be dayenu, as we Jews say. It would be enough. If she did this in one set, in one bar, in one Netflix special, it would be dayenu. But that's not how she does it. Eliza does this night after night, week after week, month after month, and year after year. She does it in more than one Netflix special, and she brings herself to late night, and she has brought you the book you are listening to right now. Girl Logic feels like a book by a comedian plenty of times. There are gems from her funny brain that had me laughing out loud again and again. But Girl Logic is also a guide for girls and women, because Eliza doesn't live to make you laugh. She lives and writes to make you think and consider and weigh your options. Heels versus flats or fake tits, her words, versus real, speak up or stay silent are decisions many women will encounter in their lives. She knows this, and she has lived inside of her brilliant brain for a long time while observing the lives of girls and women. She knows better than us in most cases, I promise. Girl Logic surprised me most because it also feels like a memoir, but not in the sappy, annoying way. And Eliza is the first to tell us she doesn't want to write a memoir. Her childhood was not tragic, it was not without its complexity, but she makes it clear that she is not an angry comic whose life led her to a world of laughter so that she wouldn't cry. What Eliza has done is to draw strength from her challenges and come out on top of every obstacle, intellectually, spiritually, and emotionally. Girl Logic opens up a part of Eliza's brain that I didn't know she was ready to share. It's the part that has been hurt. It's the part that is sometimes afraid. It's the part that wants very badly to be loved and sometimes doesn't know how. And it's the part that proves what a warrior she is in an industry which can take your sword, your shield, and your faith daily. Eliza Schlesinger is someone you may not always agree with. You may not always like her. and you may not always want to hear what she has to say. But God help you if you can't find yourself in the words of this book. Your hurt, your fear, and your loneliness will be remedied time and again with the laughter and the wisdom of a woman who will teach you to fight for your self-identification as a warrior and your destiny as a woman.
For the Girls. Introduction. Girl logic. It doesn't mean you're crazy. It just means you're a girl. Women aren't crazy. We are not crazy. We are conflicted. Crazy implies an impracticality to our thoughts when, in actuality, we're processing so many dichotomic thoughts that we get frustrated. Then others perceive that as crazy. Women want to be appreciated for their mind, but they won't stop obsessing over the size of their ass. We tell you what we want, then we get mad because you didn't realize that what we said isn't actually what we meant. We spend hours rehashing details or distinctions that men fail to notice, much less care about. I used a peach gold highlighter, not rose gold. In any given day, hell, in the span of a few hours, we might want to be worshipped, sexualized, respected, dominated, held, or simply left alone. Depends on who's around, what we ate, temperature on Venus, all kinds of factors. Are women crazy or stupid? No. Well, don't get me wrong. Some women are fucking crazy. And okay, some are a little stupid, as are some men. On the contrary, women are both afflicted and empowered by something I call girl logic. GL is a characteristically female way of thinking that appears to be contradictory and circuitous, but is actually a complicated and highly evolved way of considering every choice and its repercussions before we make a move toward what we want. What we want could be a great job, a hot dude, world domination, or a chicken sandwich. Doesn't matter. Girl logic kicks in and makes us ponder the past, present, and future all at the same time. Well, maybe I could like this guy, but he's wearing a fedora and has a snaggle tooth. Oh, but the last three good-looking guys I dated were horrible. But what if he'd be a great dad? But I'm not interested in having kids right now. I'm definitely not into him. But I might be later. Okay, I'm giving him my number and texting him when I'm bored or drunk. All this internal back and forth might sound maddening, but what girl logic is truly doing is helping to prioritize our needs and values in both the short and long term. It's anything but crazy. At its best, girl logic is a critical asset, an internal guidance system that helps women stay on track toward the thing or person they want most or the woman they most want to be. It can admittedly also kick in at the weirdest moments as we try to sort out what we want right now versus what we want later. For instance, let's say some less than savory guy you've been trying to decide whether to go out with finally texts you back after 6 hours of ignoring you. Let's say you put aside that 6 hours of silent rage you just experienced and you agree to go to the movies with him. Then, what about snacks? Girl logic kicks in to help suss out your desires, Sour Patch Kids dumped in buttered popcorn, duh, and measure them against how you'll feel once that desire is met, like a pigeon who ate too much wedding rice. Then it weighs the outcome with how you feel that day, tired and bloated, against how you want to feel, like Gwyneth Paltrow on a juice cleanse. Against reality, you're going to feel gross, so maybe just eat a few pieces, or have all of it, but with bottled water, and promise to work out extra hard for the next 3 days, but won't. Side note. FYI, I picked a white woman because it's harder for us to say young-looking. I also have a better shot at looking like Gwyneth Paltrow than I do at looking like Beyonce. Okay. While I believe girl logic is ultimately designed to help us, it can sometimes feel like a curse. GL can go a little haywire when forced to reconcile the sheer volume of expectations society places on women. See, being a woman is hard. And to that one guy who bought this to try to expand his mind, don't you dare set this book down now. Adjust your sack, hunker down, and at least read a few more pages before you go back to your fantasy draft. Most of us don't even realize all the social pressures that weigh on us from the second we wash our faces in the morning to the moment we scrape off our sunscreen, primer, concealer, cover-up, bronzer, and blush every night. The truth is that women are supposed to be everything to everyone. And guess what? That's impossible. We are expected to be continually kind to our fellow women, caring toward children, respectful of the elderly, supportive of our coworkers, while simultaneously making every dude around us super horny. Oh, and we should always stand up for ourselves while also being likable. Don't forget to be likable! We're supposed to look eternally young while aging gracefully and look hot while remaining respectable. We are supposed to be open and vulnerable but without getting too emotional. Be sexually empowered but not slutty. We're encouraged to eat whatever we want while our bodies are scrutinized for unruly curves because men like a woman who eats, not a woman who looks like she eats. Without even meaning to, we've internalized these social expectations and let them shape everything we do, say, feel, and believe. And then we spend way too much time trying to live up to unrealistic standards that were put in place before anyone reading this book was even born. Being expected to be perfect in every conceivable way, from the things we think to the amount of makeup we wear to the way we parent, run a business, have sex, or recover after childbirth, can be mind-numbing and cause our GL to blow a fuse. Or worse, cause us to cry in public or cut our own hair. One simple way to illustrate girl logic is with the common mealtime question, what do you want to eat? Most men will, perhaps unthinkingly, perhaps out of an attempt to accommodate, blurt out whatever sounds good and easy. To them, most things are black and white.
Pizza sounds cool.
Probably because they won't have their worth be judged by how good they look in a fun top. But women live in the gray, bathe in the gray, and summer in the gray. There are more than 50 shades of it, many of which don't involve S&M. We invariably consider the past, present, and future when making any choice because for us the stakes are higher emotionally, because we care about consequences, or logistically, because we are aware of consequences in the first place. If you pick the wrong shoes, your feet could end up killing you all night and tomorrow. If you push back against a coworker, you could lose your job or be harassed, ostracized, or labeled a bitch. If you text a guy after not hearing back, he might start referring to you as a desperate psycho. All these possibilities are constantly floating through our heads when considering any situation, including dinner. So instead of saying pizza, we'll take into account what we're wearing at present, too tight for pizza, what we might wear this evening, what we might be drinking, the potential messiness factor, and if the crust is made from wheat. The pizza conundrum only highlights the ongoing battle between how we see ourselves versus how we want to see ourselves versus how everyone else sees us. All of these conflicting directives are exhausting to process and can leave women spinning in circles, heading in the wrong direction, or simply crashing and burning. And by crashing and burning, I mean that feeling when you're like, I'm going to be so healthy this week, and at the end of Monday, you're rationalizing, if I don't finish the whole pint now, I'll just have to eat more of it tomorrow. It's no surprise that in so many women-centered TV shows, books, and movies, the main character suffers from a multiple personality disorder. A wife, mother, cop, alien, and trying to balance it all. When the heroine doesn't have kids, she's still a mishmash of familiar stereotypes. Chloe's trying to find Mr. Right, but is weird about commitment because she's been hurt before. Can she carry an overflowing cup of coffee and maintain a high-powered career? Can she make it work? Will love find her? I mean, can you think of any lead male character pitched as ever-frazzled Scott is trying to balance work, fathering, marriage, and his exhausting recreational tennis team? Also, the poor thing is kind of a klutz. Have you noticed that women are always klutzy when they're supposed to be adorable? Falling into boxes, knocking over food, walking while trying to look hot? Sandra Bullock, Anne Hathaway, Drew Barrymore. Apparently, men like a klutz. Not only because falling is funny, but I also suspect because being clumsy makes you seem less powerful. Plus, if they're falling down, they can't emasculate you. This book is both a commiseration and a celebration of girl logic. I'll discuss the way we collectively think, but also give you some insight into my own personal experiences and how they connect to GL. I wrote it because I wanted to give women a break from the never-ending stream of nonsense in our mental inbox telling us we're wrong for feeling how we feel. Psycho bitch, bad feminist, single weirdo, mean girl, crazy ex-girlfriend, female comic. These loaded labels are constantly applied to women as a way to write us off. This book is my effort to help you tune out all that unnecessary chatter from within and without and keep your GL working for you instead of against you. I wrote this book to let all girls know that whatever psycho thoughts you've had, I've had them too. Sometimes my GL causes me to suffer a break in reality. I've been paralyzed between two outfits because one is sexy and one is comfortable, which leads to a fit of heavy scrutinizing of both my clothes and my life choices. I've censored myself in a conversation for fear of not being liked, only to replay it over and over, acting out different witty retorts should the exact conversation ever occur again. I've wolfed down a ham steak while thinking, whatever, I can just work out harder tomorrow. And then when tomorrow came, I was tired and rationalized, whatever, I'll just eat less today. What a fun cycle of delusion. And thanks to GL, nothing will send me into a mad rage more than texting a boy who doesn't write back. We made out once, and I asked you if you wanted to get coffee. This doesn't have to be complicated! I see the three dots moving, Scott! I know you're there! But there is a method to the madness, as I'll show you in this book. See, GL can also work in positive ways. Yes, GL will sometimes fill your head with exhausting thoughts and options. Do I really want to buy that, do that, eat that, date that? 1,000 reasons why that might not be a good idea to start from. But it can also be a rallying cry to take on the world. I've got this. I've totally got this. I've done it before. I can do it again. I will regret it forever if I don't do it right now! That's the great part of girl logic. It nudges us to push ourselves, question what we want, and refine our own ideas about what will make us happier, better people. It's GL that keeps us engaged in so many more things than men could ever dream of doing. Just imagine your mom, or your aunt, or your best friend's mom. You know, all those real-life 60-something women taking a Spanish class on a Monday night, a pottery class on Tuesday, attending a lecture on Wednesday, seeing the opera on Thursday, an art opening on Friday, and doing educational yoga retreats each summer? Sometimes their GL is working overtime trying to help them figure out what would make them happy. I'm Cheryl. I'm taking an earthenware formation class while learning about mushroom whispering. I'm flirting with bead making, but cooking with sustainable thoughts is my new passion. And just because you took on Oprah and Deepak's 21-day meditation experience and only got through day 3, doesn't mean you failed. It means you are 3 days closer to being the person you wanted to be, or thought you wanted to be. Now think of your dad. He's probably had the same one or two hobbies all his life, right? Okay, fine, maybe. Some dads eventually get into motorcycles or dating Asian women. My point exactly. Understanding girl logic is a way of embracing both our aspirations and our contradictions. GL is a desire to be both strong and vulnerable. It's wanting to be curvy but rail thin at the same time. It's striving to kick ass in a man's world while still being loved by the women around you. Your GL is that little voice in your head that makes you aware of the practicality of your everyday choices and how they'll shape your reality tomorrow. If you don't read the Washington Post tonight, you'll be left out of the conversation tomorrow. Of course, there's always the dangling carrot of instant gratification. But what I really need to do is unwind with some Instagram cake decorating videos. I've earned it. And here comes girl logic, swooping in to remind you how you felt last time you did that. Didn't you say your New Year's resolution was being more informed? It's your job to consider the options from every angle. Your GL presents them all to you, and the one that weighs heaviest wins. Okay. I'll read a Washington Post tweet, then I can, unencumbered by guilt, watch these Snapchats of regional cheerleading competitions. So why am I talking about this? Me of all people out there. No, I don't have a sociology degree, and I'm certainly not a psychologist. I'm a stand-up comic who has spent a lifetime obsessed with questioning things and observing people, especially fellow women, and calling out the humor and the pathos in their, our, contradictory behavior. I've collected a lot of data, and now I get to put it in a book. I wanted to do a baking cookbook, but it would have been all blank pages. The last page would just say, I don't like chocolate, sorry. This book is my attempt to continue that conversation, to rip open my girl brain and spill it out for you so you can say, hey, wait, hers kind of looks like mine. The truth is all women sometimes feel misunderstood, including me. I, too, want thinner thighs. I, too, have freaked out at that bitch Stacy after she got the promotion gig part I wanted. I, too, have gotten pissed about not being pretty enough and then in the next breath gotten even more pissed at the idea that I have to look pretty at all. But I love that I got to write this book for you. It's for all the young girls who think they figured it out, which is adorable, but because you're still shopping at LF, you haven't. It's for frustrated women in their 20s and 30s who thought they had it figured out until life was like, wait till you see my dick. It's for older women, too, who might reminisce about the good old confusing days as they give a throaty laugh in their flowy Chico's pants. And this book is also for me, because apparently expounding on stage for 2 hours a night wasn't enough. Trust me, if I could start a cult, I would. But I hate the idea of deliberately dying in a group. This book is a celebration of women in all our gray and all our glory. It's meant to remind you that no matter how kooky, conflicted, or off-kilter your girl logic may sometimes skew, that very same thinking bonds you with countless other women across the globe. And it serves a purpose. I promise. Chapter 1. You're a woman. Be confident, but not so confident that it makes anyone else insecure, is actually what they mean. I wasn't always so aware. In my early stand-up years, I was known for making fun of women, specifically the way some of us behave when we're desperate, hungry, or drunk. I felt I had license to do it because I'd lived it. I was in my mid-20s, so my girl logic was a little less informed and a lot less evolved than it is today. I thought I had a monopoly on describing nights out that start with aimlessly wandering, jacketless, through the cold to find a bar, sharing a flatbread so we don't feel too fat, crying lemon drop and chemical imbalance-fueled tears, eating terrible 3 a.m. tacos, and waking up for work with last night's makeup still looking sort of good and thinking, hey, I can pull this off. This was my life, and the life of most women my age. But when I look back, I can't help but question my own harshness. I remember doing one joke where I called a line of drunk girls holding hands to walk through a crowded dance floor a chain of whores. Surprisingly, women loved it. Fans have even put that joke on t-shirts and worn them to my shows. But if I had to do it again, I wouldn't have used that word. I was playing on lazy stereotypes. It may pack a punch, but as a constantly evolving woman and comedian, it's my job to look beyond the humor and ask myself if I want to be part of making a derogatory word commonplace. I don't. Something clicked in April of 2015. I was watching television as a male comic publicly shamed a female comic I knew and liked. He called her out by name and made fun of everything from her looks to her personality. His jokes were brutal and unabashed, and the insult to the injury was that they weren't funny. I found myself growing seriously pissed at this anti-woman labeling and judging and feeling so righteously steadfast that what he was doing was, well, wrong, that I decided to write a rebuttal piece for a popular website. It was like I was on a literary schoolyard, a classmate had been pushed down, and I was the only one who could help her back up. I've had a front row seat to the constant verbal backlash, write-offs, rumors, and never-ending pissing contests women are subjected to in comedy. It just so happened that on that day, for that girl, I could help. Did I change her life or his? Doubtful. But sometimes you see something shitty happening, and life asks, are you going to stay silent or stand up for what you think is right, even if not everyone hears? After my piece went up, my small act of protest lit a fire in me. I realized, as a woman in my 30s, that it was no longer acceptable to use my platform to talk solely about drunk mistakes, nor was that the totality of my existence. It was time to say things on stage that were both funny and meaningful. So I used that perspective to write and shape my Netflix special, Confirmed Kills. I wanted, and still want, women to arm themselves with confidence, so they'll be that much more prepared the next time someone decides to publicly question why they exist. I admit I used to make my own negative judgments, chain of whores, about other women because one of the trickier aspects of girl logic is that it affects both how we see ourselves and how we see other women. It can destabilize our sense of self, making us compare ourselves to and dismiss other women, more on female competition later in the book. Girl logic dictates that we should all be confident and empowered, but not too vain or full of ourselves. Otherwise, people will talk. If you're pretty, you must be stupid. If you're fat, you must not be pretty. If you lose the weight and show off your body, then you're slutty, showing, annoying, too in shape. Really, there is an endless list of shitty superlatives that can be applied to anything positive you do. It's hard to win, either in the real world or inside our heads. But women need to find solidarity in our similarity, to recognize that we're all making sense even when we aren't making sense. Make sense? When I was growing up in Texas and playing lacrosse in high school, there was a fanatical emphasis on acting like ladies when we were representing our school. As if the entire perception of our institution rested on how we conducted ourselves on the field for a sport no one was watching anyway. Act like ladies. What does that mean? Be nice, cordial, quiet, faint on a nearby couch? Acting like a man means taking charge and often being tough. Why would I want to be delicate during sports? You see in professional sports, too. Male athletes get paid more, but they also get into fights, yell at refs, and occasionally rape or kill someone. Frankly, I think part of Ronda Rousey's appeal at the height of her career was that she broke away from the shake hands and smile at your opponent knee-length skirt model of athleticism that she and other female athletes have been taught to emulate. Instead, she was straight up aggressive. She said what was on her mind, and she could back it up. She was our Dennis Rodman. Serena Williams, too. She's fierce as fuck. And when she isn't happy, she lets it rip, like when she smashed that racket at Wimbledon. Pretty awesome, if you ask me. People don't know how to process female aggression, though. They often mislabel it as negativity. I've definitely been called negative. But why? Because I pace on stage, yell in my jokes, and use my body? Because when I don't like things, I call them out? Because I don't back down when it upsets someone who shouldn't have come at me in the first place? To me, negativity is a powerful tool. It reminds us to never get too comfortable. I call myself a realist, though, or maybe a pessimistic optimist. I believe in good, that it will all work out, but I refuse to blindly bump into unnecessary hurdles along the way. Anyway, point is, more women should be like Miss Rousey and Miss Williams, not only strong and indomitable, but also unapologetic and able to back it up. Thankfully, there are role models in every field. In comedy, we've got Tina Fey, Amy Poehler, Melissa McCarthy, Kate McKinnon, and hell, all the women on SNL. And take a look at Jennifer Saunders, who might be my biggest role model in comedy. All of them are ballsy and unafraid to give an intelligent opinion, commentary, or impression, even if it, God forbid, offends people, play an ugly character, or simply be who they are. In politics, we have more and more women like Elizabeth Warren, and in business, we have more and more female CEOs at Fortune 500 companies. And yet, despite all of these positive strides and role models, women still unwittingly succumb to micro forms of passivity every day. We wear heels we can't run in and dresses we can't breathe in. We don't leave the house without lipstick. Gotta make sure your lips look like plump vaginas. And we do smoky eye makeup because it's sexy, even though it makes it look like we just choked on a dick and cried. We try to stay as thin as possible, which also keeps us weak. When you're skinny, you have no body fat. When you have no body fat, you're cold all the time. And when you're cold all the time, you stay inside. And when you stay inside, you don't vote. I may be joking about that last part, but I'm not totally wrong. Ever stop to think that by keeping women eternally preoccupied with superficialities that we might be missing out on the important things in life? Just imagine if we could consistently direct that crazy mental energy to lift ourselves up instead of put ourselves down. Because when you are truly secure in yourself, when you can analyze situations and figure out what's best for you based on you and not some preconceived notion of what society expects, then nothing is a threat. Except mountain lions. There's one that's constantly loose in my neighborhood. Oh my God, and it ate a neighbor's cat. Work it if you got it. I know I'm not perfect. But despite an insane number of persistently irrational delusions, believing I'll magically wake up tan, understand the subjunctive tense in Spanish, and I'll suddenly be able to wear a flowy tank top without looking pregnant, perhaps the only one I've managed to avoid is the idea that I'm not good enough. Instead, I suffer from chronic overconfidence. It's not that I'm impervious to girl logic-fueled self-questioning. I'm as human as the rest of you. It's that in the best of situations, as I've gotten older, I've learned to channel my GL correctly. I've trained myself to listen to my GL when it's pointing me toward the thing that feels most authentically right for me in the long term, and to ignore it, sometimes, when it's obsessively projecting past fears or rejections onto whatever weirdness is happening in the moment. If I smile at a guy who doesn't return it, I might spin out into a momentary fog of self-doubt, but my heart won't stop beating, and my day won't be ruined. If I tell a joke that doesn't get a laugh, so what? There's another joke right after it. Most decisions we make are fear-based. The decision to not take a chance because we're afraid to fail, to not wear an outfit out of fear of looking bad, to not tell someone we're upset with them because we're scared of confrontation. If you reduce it down, the reality is that of the 10,000 decisions we make every day, very few of them actually matter to your future, and often taking the risk will help you gain more than you'll lose. For instance, take the common refrain, I don't want to text him because the last guy I texted right after a date never texted me back. You're letting your hang-ups from past rejection guide your present decision-making, when in actuality, this is a new guy and a new situation and a more evolved you. Most of us progress as we get older, right? He either will or won't write you back, and if he doesn't, so what? There's no way you loved him so much that it's going to hurt for long. Despite the fact that you've already tried out what your first name sounds like with his last name and maybe made a few allowances regarding his lifestyle. He loves taxidermy, so maybe I could learn to stuff like a cute mouse or something. Truth is, why would you want to date a flake? For God's sakes, there are celebrities out there who have killed people. No one cares and you're still a fan. They're still celebrities. You think the world's going to notice if you send one dumb email wearing the wrong shoes or wink at a guy who doesn't like you? When I don't get a part, I'm shocked. But why was it even between me and Jennifer Hudson in the first place? When a guy doesn't call me back, I'm floored. You have a roommate and use an iPhone for your photography. You have an illegitimate child and you aren't calling me back? Blocked. You are dead to me. Let me reassure you. My confidence isn't based on any solid, irrefutable reason. There's never been anything in my life I truly excelled at aside from comedy, and even that is subjective. I'm not a rapper, I'm not a model, I'm not an athlete, I don't know a good investment when I see one, I have no idea how to wear horizontal stripes correctly, and everyone has insecurities, of course. Me, I hate my thighs. I can never wear the tight pants that fashion wants me to wear because my thighs are not those of a 10-year-old Japanese boy. This torments me daily, so what do? I accept the existence of my meaty haunches, and I do squats. I figure, if they're going to be big, let's make them strong. P.S. Thanks, hip-hop culture, for making it easier for women with meat on their bodies to show it off, and for allowing more men to admit they like it. But stop body-shaming thin girls, you might cry out, to which I would cry back, I am thin, and I don't feel shamed, just slightly annoyed most of the time. Moral of the story. Let our bodies be our bodies. Quit studying and labeling them. No one looks at a linebacker and says, wow, it's amazing he found a niche spot in the NFL. He's so confident. Me, I like myself, thighs and all. I know it's sort of de rigueur to hate yourself. Ugh, I'm such a hot mess. I'm so pathetic. But I won't make jokes like that because they only feed the idea that women should hate themselves. I might say I have the table manners of a starving coyote or that I'm dumb because I think if I just chew Sour Patch Kids fast, that will somehow burn calories. But deep down, I don't believe there's anything I can't do. If someone told me I had to choreograph a Broadway show, I think I could do it. Part of me secretly thinks I might be the best singer in the world. Delusional? Totally. I like to think high school was all the things I was bad at. Math, essays, chemistry, running, and cleaning my room. And now as an adult, I only have to do the things I'm good at. Comedy, sleeping, squeezing my dog, texting back, hustling. Like I said, I'm not superhuman. I've just grown and changed a lot and learned how to make my GL work for me instead of against me when it comes to believing in myself and accomplishing my goals. Anyway, there wasn't that one summer when I got my braces off and came out of my shell or some life-changing moment where I saw Richard Pryor and thought, OMG, comedy is what I'm born to do. That confidence was just always there. Humor has always been my thing, and before me, it was my parents' thing, and before them, it was my grandparents' thing. Thanksgivings are exhausting in our house. It's never let me down, and it's having this thing that's helped me feel good about myself, even when I was younger and supposed to be writing self-pitying journal entries. Okay, fine. I may have written a few of those too. Whatever. Maybe your thing is an awesomely exaggerated body part, or an innate ability to sing, or the fact that you don't get squeamish around bodily fluids. Hi, natural-born ER doctor or serial killer. You can rage against it, but if this thing benefits you and others, why not embrace it? If you're a genius, you will always know the answer. If you're gorgeous, you will always stand out in a crowd. If you're an athlete, you will always be good at sports and evading arrest. And if you're funny, you will always be able to make at least one person in the room laugh. And that's a beautiful and valuable thing. Quick aside, some of you folks reading this might be in high school. If so, I want to tell you something. It really does get better. Unless you're a mean weirdo, you'll most likely end up being praised as an adult for the very things you were mocked for in high school. So just hold on a little longer. There's nothing wrong with knowing how good you are, and there's nothing wrong with taking time to figure that out. One positive aspect of GL is that all its obsessive loops of self-talk can actually help you psych yourself up, be a little prouder, and do your best no matter what you're doing. Plus, there's nothing wrong with being cocky, especially as a woman. You don't have to be a jerk, but there's nothing wrong with being confident. The next time you look great or do something amazing and someone compliments you, just say, I know, thank you. The only time cockiness doesn't work is when you can't back it up. It's also worth noting that cockiness is generally considered a male trait, named for a male body part that was named after a male chicken, a cockerel. A cockerel's job is to hang out with all the hens and fertilize the eggs and be super aggressive and make a lot of noise. So now you get it. Confident women aren't called snoochy, but maybe we should be. I'm snoochy. Now tell me how good I look and get out of my way or I will suffocate you. Are you still with me? What's that? You're listening to this book on the toilet? Gross. Anyway, we were talking about confidence. The true kind that comes from knowing what you're good at and what you're worth. The kind of confidence that gives you the courage to demand what you deserve, even when you're the only one who thinks you deserve it. The way I figure, If you operate from the assumption that nobody knows anything, which is largely true in show business, as it is in most other industries, except, I guess, like the CIA, I feel like they know a lot, then one of three things happen when you ask for what you deserve. One, you ask and they say yes. Two, you ask and they realize, oh, wow, I didn't realize she was worth that much. She must know something we don't. Three, they say no, but they walk away knowing you value yourself or that you're wildly off base in your assessment of your value. But the point is, you tried. People will always respect you for trying or think you're annoying, but at least they will remember you. And hey, when you turn out to be a success, they'll look back on it like, oh, should have given her a chance. I think a lot of us start out with this sort of confidence and end up losing it somewhere along the way. Our girl logic gets stuck in a negative loop and overrides our ability to see ourselves clearly. If I ask for a raise and they don't give it to me, then I'll feel awkward. And if I feel awkward, then I won't feel comfortable speaking up at work and I might start to do a bad job. And then they'll be like, ooh, the nerve on her to ask for a raise when she isn't even good at what she does in the first place. When I was little, I had a strong sense of what I would and would not tolerate and of what I knew was right, even if I was wrong. I thought most other people were wrong, and I wasn't totally wrong to think that. I'm reminded of my first and only experience modeling in a childhood fashion show. I was 5 years old, doing a JCPenney kids show. They stuck me in an ugly pink and red apron with giant quilted hearts all over it and white tights. White tights! Quilted anything. I threw a fit. It was ugly. My mother pulled me aside and explained, these are professionals, and you'll wear what they tell you. I did this stupid fashion show, walked off stage, and ripped the outfit from my body. Right there, in that multi-purpose room in the employee section of the Prestonwood Mall, my fashion career was finished. Was I wrong to throw a fit? Maybe. Does anyone here remember a time in children's fashion when pink and red quilted heart aprons and white tights were chic? Nope! That sense that I knew best, because so many other people were clearly inept, has followed me through my life. Most people know a lot about, like, three things. Just because someone is in charge doesn't mean they should be. And just because they can express an opinion doesn't mean you should listen to it. Executives create bad shows. Politicians do horrible things on purpose. Stylists send people out on red carpets wearing garbage trash. Hey, I've been on sets where the makeup artist made my eyebrows so dark I look like an angry cartoon monkey. I walked on set and my Mexican hairdresser looked at my face and was like, Changa! I've read magazine articles about me with my name misspelled two different ways in print. Not everyone is in a position of authority because they worked for it. No. Most people get where they are because the guy ahead of them died, they knew someone, or they simply did a decent enough job long enough that eventually they got promoted. Is constantly questioning everything and everyone exhausting? Yes! But it's how I'm wired. Is it because I'm Jewish and our religious pastime is sitting around asking why? Perhaps. Or maybe. When it comes to certain areas of my life, my girl logic is stuck in high gear, pushing me to constantly do more, achieve more, checking and double-checking that things are going well. I've seen enough fuck-ups in my own experience that I've chosen to be on the offense to mitigate any impending poor decisions being made on my behalf. Because at the end of the day, it's your career, life, face, image, and feelings on the line, and no one should care or have the power to fuck things up for you more than you. On a deeper level, I've always believed I deserved respect. Sure, I had the same nitpicky, self-doubting thoughts every other girl has growing up. My girl logic at times drove me bonkers when I'm hit with a spin cycle of what if they don't think I'm cool enough? And should I just stay quiet and see what happens? GL urges you to demand respect, but it also reminds you that the path to achieving it can be riddled with name-calling, doubt, and struggle. I mean, no one wants to be feared and hated. Except maybe Putin. Oh, and Kim Jong, any of them. But if you think about all the decisions and all the hardship and pain that have gone into getting you to this point in your life, is it so insane to think that maybe you've been through enough? Is it so insane to think you deserve to be treated like a worthy human? As I got older and learned more about myself, my GL evolved with me. Fortunately, it changed in a way that helped boost my confidence instead of bring it down. I learned to expect people to respect me because I respected myself. Of course, this was also partially instilled by my strong, smart, independent single mother and her take-no-crap New York attitude. I want to note here that anything good that's happened to me in my life is directly because of my mom. As a teenager, I was lucky enough to have body confidence. Inexplicably. Well, maybe not that inexplicable. I had boobs. When I was 13, my neighbor Aaron threw a pool party. Aaron was 13, too.
Fortunately, this isn't a story about getting molested by a man next door. I know, the second I said when I was 13 and neighbor, it sounded like it was going that way. The guys at the party asked the girls to take part in a swimsuit contest. Hey, we were teenagers in Plano, Texas in the 90s. None of us had a clue what sexism was. Me being me, I jumped at the opportunity. I knew that with a chest like mine, I was totally going to win the prize, a coveted $20 Blockbuster gift card. Don't get me wrong, I wasn't hot or anything, though I did have the best Far Side t-shirt collection in all the land. But I learned that boobs meant something, particularly after my friend Sandra's mother, a life-size 5'10 Barbie doll with long ripples of blonde hair, said to me, "Good God, child, I wish I had your chest." What I gleaned from this powerfully inappropriate statement was that the most beautiful woman I knew was jealous of something I had. Talk about an ego boost. Though the other girls might have been able to wear braces and still look cute, what the hell? I thought I had the swimsuit competition on lock. And yet, no sooner had we lined up, my grown woman chest all pigeon-puffed out, than Aaron declared Angela, my sun-in blonde nemesis. Who didn't know she was my nemesis? And honestly, I would have been excited if she wanted to hang out with me. The winner. Aaron obviously has a crush on Angela. That's why she won. I seethed to myself as I threw a Yaga shirt over my Esprit tankini. Truth be told, Angela was prettier than me, at least by Texas standards. Cute nose, a perpetual tan, and the all-courant haircut, the Rachel, that went on to be mocked round the world. As for me, I had blonde curls that broke at my temples and sort of hovered above my head like a halo of fuzz. I never did my hair, save the one time I did like 10 braids to try to resemble the yellow sweater-wearing version of Alanis Morissette in the Ironic video, remember, in the car? I'd inherited my dad's prominent snout, a nose that trickled down my Nana's bloodline and had been dubbed the Chinsky Hook. What young girl doesn't dream of having a nose name for a Polish snaring device? This is the part of the book where you're blessed with the realization that I had a nose job at 18. I'm Jewish, and no one's ever asked me about my surgery, so it was obviously a good one. But was I insecure about my nose? More than anything. I would sit in class and hide my profile because I thought it was so hideous. No one made fun of me, except for one kid who called me Rhino Nose, and I'll never forget it, because I had a crush on him. In hindsight, he wasn't even that cute, which made him more attainable, and still he thought I was ugly? What a punch in the hook. I didn't feel ugly, though. I just knew I had an ugly nose, and the universe had made a mistake. Now, back to the pool, and back to me always knowing I'm right, and that the universe is out to get me. What infuriated me was that the poolside competition wasn't a face contest. It was supposed to be about how your body looked in a swimsuit. Those were the rules. Not face, body. And yet, right there, in that Texas backyard, I had my first foray into the cruel world of superficial judgments and began to understand that life wasn't fair. Oddly, I hadn't fully absorbed that lesson when my parents got divorced, which didn't faze me. I don't know where Angela is now, but I'm sure that early confirmation of her hotness has served her just fine in this life, and that she's grown up to be a wonderful nurse or receptionist or benefits administrator or whatever in fill-in-the-blank Texas. Probably with carloads of good-looking, all-American, perpetually bronzed kids. I just searched for her on Facebook. Turns out she went to Stanford and now runs a huge charity. Wow, I totally misjudged her. Wait, aha! She does have good-looking children, see? I called it! Thankfully, the jury-rigged bikini contest didn't scar me too badly, and I came to believe that I was somewhere just above average on the attractiveness scale. It has since occurred to me that without the marvels of modern medical advances like acne cream and braces and surgery and Instagram filters, most of us would walk around looking like absolute she-rats all the time. Sometimes I wonder, if I were a peasant in the 1600s, what I would have looked like. Cystic acne, Chinsky hook, and snaggle teeth running wild. I'd probably be married off to a hog farmer, or perhaps hung as a witch. I got my aforementioned nose job right before I went to college. At first, I told my friends that something had fallen on my face, and everyone believed it. This was Dallas, not Long Island. No one in my school got nose jobs, so it seemed plausible that a gigantic wooden Martha's Vineyard fresh fish here sign from my parents' living room could land on my face. Plus, we were all off to college. No one else had time to think about my nose. All I can tell you is that I woke up from surgery, eyes black and blue, with a broken, swollen piggy nose, so sensitive I'd cry if you touched it with your pinky. I looked in the mirror, and through my bleary eyes, realized that I'd never felt prettier or more normal. That was my standard of beauty. If you have a big nose and you keep it, that's awesome. My point is, I didn't like something about myself, so I changed it. I didn't mock other girls with bumpy noses, and I never hated girls who had perfect noses. Insecurities are a personal thing, and you should handle them and not project them on anyone else. To me, a little plastic surgery is no different from losing a little weight or changing your hair color. If tweaking one thing will help you feel better about yourself, why not do it? Just know that deciding to alter a superficial flaw, quote-unquote, won't necessarily fix whatever emotional weirdness you might be holding on inside about said flaw. Tons of fat people who've lost weight via natural means, surgery, or anything else still say they feel fat inside. Plenty of people who change their faces still don't feel attractive. And while I don't struggle with many self-esteem issues, there have been and will continue to be plenty of times I flat out decided, I'm not pretty enough for that guy. Attraction is animalistic, not merit-based, and people will, either out of politeness or genuine shock, scoff at you if you say you aren't pretty or another woman is prettier. But just because someone's more attractive than me doesn't mean I don't think I deserve to live. I just call them like I see them. I'll admit it, I think I'm pretty now. Some of the time, anyway. When I'm at my best doing stand-up, I'm not pretty. In any action shots of me on stage, I'm never making a decent face or not hunched over like a party goblin. But rejection always hurts, and the younger it happens to you, the more of a mark it makes. I'll never forget being 14 at summer camp and thinking this one kid was cute. We were all going to sit in a circle, and I went and sat next to him quietly. Everyone was milling about, so he got up and he moved. So I waited a few seconds and moved too. When I sat down next to him again, not making eye contact or saying a word, he looked at me and said, "Stop trying to sit next to me." Like I was some hideous fart beast who kept licking him. Ever ready with a verbal quip, I snipped, I'm not. When he moved again, I dared not follow. Small as that was, for years afterward, I felt I shouldn't look at boys because I was offending them. As for me, my own self-confidence stems not just from the notion that I'm a good person, worthy of love and respect, but that I am, well, just a tiny bit better than some people. I know that's a lofty statement, one that could easily be misread, misinterpreted, or simply make me sound like a big bitch. But honestly, it just boils down to being a decent person who does decent things. I hate when, in an argument between women, the conversation devolves to, "So you think you're better than everyone?" And the other girl reflexively quacks back, "Oh my God, who, me? No, of course not." If you tried that with me, the conversation would go like this. Them. "So you think you're better than everyone?" Me. "No, not everyone, just some. Okay, and maybe you." In a perfect world, we would all have a little societal Yelp rating floating above our heads to indicate to others right off the bat whether we're garbage people or not. Wouldn't it be great if you could meet someone and immediately see their 5-star review that reads, "Stacy gives to charity, adopted an animal, is a great friend, and cares for her grandma." Then you could compare her to Todd, who has 2 stars but seemed so cool. You'd read, "Todd lives off his parents, deliberately gave his last girlfriend chlamydia, has a coke problem, and once postmated a bottle of Jack because he didn't feel like walking downstairs to 7-Eleven. Oh, also he vapes. Competitively." Side note, between the writing and publishing of this book, a Black Mirror episode came out with a similar idea about human ratings. So I just want you to know that I had it first. 5 stars! Yep, most people are the worst. Not you, of course. You obviously have great taste and humor, not to mention you're listening to an actual book, which is more than I can say for most people. Fine, I admit it. We tried to condense this book into 5 silly memes about puppy sleeping, but I felt like my message was getting lost. And work it if you don't got it. Before I won Last Comic Standing, before I accomplished something unique, nothing in my life suggested I was going to be anything special to anyone besides my mother, Ronnie. I wasn't great at school, a B and C student, but my saving grace was that I really put in a solid effort. So in challenging subjects that only Stephen Hawking could understand, like Algebra 101, the teachers loved me because I tried so, so hard. Just kidding. My secret was that I spent most of my time looking like I was trying. I'd meet with the teacher, do extra credit, anything I could to show I was going through the motions of learning, but wasn't actually learning, because for me, math is boring and impossible. On tests, I lived to hear, "Oh, you were so close, and I know you were struggling with this, and I noticed you wrote down the right answer, then erase it, so I'll give you half a point." Success! I scratched my way to a mediocre GPA 1 pity point at a time. I did the studying, I had the tutors, and middle school I cheated by storing information on my TI-83. I took the after-school brush-up classes, but it wasn't clicking. I'm speaking about math and chemistry here. Any other subject was fine. To this day, I can still recite the Middle English prologue of the Canterbury Tales. But there comes a point in your academic career when you have to surrender to the fact that you just don't and never will understand math. Then you have to let that cold, hard reality manifest itself in your GPA as it will. I knew I'd thrive if I could just move past the school thing and enter the real world where talent and creativity matter, LOL, instead of the blind memorization of theorems and chemical equations. It would all start with college. There, they would see me for the endlessly creative and magical creature I was. I would make my art, be lauded for my humor, and shamelessly wear pajamas to class and easily gain 10 pounds my freshman year and sophomore year. Whatever, it's hard to make healthy choices when the food is always in the dining hall. A 24-hour yogurt bar? Are you fucking kidding me? What kind of a scrumptious heaven hell is this? Back to my fantasy world. My girl logic was part of the engine pushing me to disregard the crap I'd learned in high school, like play sports and join clubs you don't care about because other kids do it, plus it will look good on your application. My girl logic kept whispering that deep down, the creativity I'd been fostering would simply have to be rewarded because it was my time. I thought, this is the path for all funny people. No one understands you, and then one day, you're famous! First step toward that? College. Could I have skipped that step and moved right to LA at 18? Yeah, but with no training, skills, or know-how, also the fact that not going to college was just not an option in my wildest imagination, I can tell you for a fact that I would have ended up making a lot of money doing something shady, like managing the HR department at Vivid Video, all while justifying to my parents, I'm nowhere near the porn, it's a normal company with great insurance packages. But to stay creative, I would end up doing some long-form improv in Burbank on weekends, and my troupe would have some hilarious name like Hot Dog Time Machine. No, college was the way. I would go there, and my teachers and fellow students wouldn't even notice how bad I was with trig or how low my standardized test scores were. They'd see something deeper in me. They'd spot my raw talent and pick up on the fact that I had a heart of a great comedic artist. I would head off to film school and move to LA and become a famous funny person, the breezy celebrity who claims her airplane essentials are Hermes scarves, Valentino loafers, and canned placenta dust for the protein, of course. So I visited, researched, and sent personal essays to the best film schools in the country. NYU, Sarah Lawrence, Bard, Syracuse, Vassar, USC, Ithaca, BU, UT, Chapman, Pomona, Emerson College, Northwestern. I was rejected by every single one of them. Not even waitlisted. I couldn't even hang on to the possibility that the kid ahead of me would die or have a hallucinogenic mushroom-fueled meltdown and let me nab his spot. My confidence, however, remained unwavering. I couldn't grasp why these schools didn't want me. So what if I came in far below average in all the traditional litmus tests of academic aptitude? I had moxie, and I used words like moxie. But nope, it wasn't enough. This time, there would be no half points awarded for perceived effort. Drat. Of course, the truth was that I hadn't earned entrance to those schools, and I was delusional to think I'd get in. My fantasy-driven GL had been pushing me in a positive direction. Of course, deciding to go to college and pursue the arts was obviously a good idea. But in the excitement of pursuing my dream, I decided that inherent creativity would have to override things like grades, athletic achievement, and academic ability. Sure, I'd tested into a competitive prep school in Dallas, but I had a horrific SAT score. Sorry, I already told you I had a nose job. You don't get to know my shitty SAT score. That number dies with me. I took no honor classes, and I was on JV on every sport until I did lacrosse, where there weren't enough of us for JV and varsity, so we were just one team. I dropped out of the stock market club 3 weeks in because it was nothing like the movie Wall Street, and I couldn't be in the Spanish club because even after 6 years of the language, I was still speaking in solamente present tense, though I knew tons of random vocab words about airplanes and vegetables. I applied to the University of Kansas in case hell froze over, which was, as I would come to find out, exactly how locals describe the winter weather there. I soaked up KU for a year, had a blast, and then transferred to Emerson College in Boston. That's right, on my second try, I got into Emerson and felt validated. Years later, as I accepted Emerson's Young Alumni Achievement Award for winning Last Comic Standing, I would tell the students that just because they don't see it in you doesn't mean it's not there. I doubt anyone involved with that award knew Emerson's administration had rejected me the first time around. I also want to point out that I was granted that award for winning another award based on skills I had acquired through a lifetime of rejection. All because, before I was anybody, I thought I was somebody. Given all that, it's probably not surprising that I became a stand-up comic, a job that requires a surplus of confidence to combat all the rejection and wheel-spinning of show business. I was surprised, though, that before long, the media at my level being bloggers, morning show DJs, other comics whispering, had labeled me a hot girl in comedy, another moniker I hadn't really earned. "She's hot," people would vomit out, sometimes followed by, "so she can't be funny," or worse, "she's hot, so I'm going to be a complete shit to her because I'm still butthurt that the prom queen didn't date me in high school." Out of nowhere, I had this new identity that came with a false perception that my life had been easy, that I'd always been the favored pretty girl who got everything she wanted. Motherfuckers, funny was all I ever had. So sad, huh? "Oh, people thought you were so pretty, boo-hoo." I'll liken it to this. What if you had been heavy your whole life, and then you moved to, say, Milwaukee, and suddenly everyone around you was twice your size? Sounds great, right? Sure, until people start calling you a bitch, because to them, you're thin, and you're left thinking, what the hell? What did I do to you? I don't deserve this. I've dealt with shit, too. On the road, one of the necessary evils we comedians encounter is the morning radio DJ. Morning DJs, thoughtful cultural commentators that they are, love to say things like,
"So is doing stand-up hard as a hot chick? Are you single? What's your favorite sex position?"
Who asks that of a stranger at 7 a.m.? What's that got to do with me letting you know that I'm at the giggle bucket this weekend?
"Is it hard being hot and being on the road? Is it hard being hot and ordering dinner?"
I was sitting there with no celebrity boyfriends, no pageants, no trophies or modeling credits and bags under my eyes, and I'm supposed to talk about what life has been like for a hot girl? Go fuck yourselves. "You know what's hard?" I wanted to tell them. "Running on 3 hours of sleep while being interviewed by a failed open micer with an inferiority complex. I'm trying to sell tickets. I'm sorry your dick isn't everything you'd hoped it would be. See me at the Funny Bone this Friday!" Because I'm blonde and outspoken, people assume I've always been the mean girl, the head cheerleader. But those kind of assumptions encapsulate a whole other aspect of girl logic, having to deal with other women's GL. For example, a girl who was mocked for being dorky in high school might grow up, look at me, and write me off thinking, "I'm not even going to bother. She's just going to be mean to me. All blonde girls were and are terrible." It's a classic GL loop, turning something that happened in the past into a negative expectation that will eternally color your present and future. Whatever, though. I'm not going to write a book about how being an upper-middle-class white girl who had her college paid for has been hard. Black, white, brown, fat, thin, ugly, pretty, molested, everybody has their shit, and everybody has stories about how they overcame it. Or didn't. Some people write books from prison, I guess. Did I have a hard life? I had my struggles. But I've never been discriminated against because of my skin color. I've never been overweight. I've never gone without food. I've never been abused. My objective isn't for you to pity me. I only aim to tell you my story. And let me share something with you that I didn't do much thinking on until I was writing this book. For my whole life, I struggled to make friends. I changed schools 5 times between first grade and high school, and I always had to adjust to new social rules. Everywhere I went, people already had their cliques, so I was constantly fighting to be included. My mother showed me a letter I wrote to God in the 2nd grade where I asked him to make all the girls in my class fall asleep so I could whisper to them that they should invite me to their sleepovers. I think having a sense of self and being hyper-aware from a young age made me, I think it was my nose. But not being included and that sense of exclusion leaves kids thinking they aren't important and are easily forgotten. Which brings us to my present-day dilemma. My biggest fear in life, aside from being kidnapped and having my mouth duct-taped shut and then being unable to communicate that I can't breathe through my nose, is feeling like I never existed. After high school and college, it felt like I was walking through life alone. Though I still have a few close friends from my younger days, I'm not in touch with 99% of the people I went to college or high school with. Depending on what else was going on at the time, my GL would either tell me to withdraw completely or to keep reaching out, but I usually didn't because I felt too disregarded. As a result, I've created a relationship with my fans in which I get back a lot of what I've always needed, not only acceptance, but being wanted in the first place. In a way, my independence born out of rejection has been a good thing. Because of my past, I'm super sensitive to people feeling included. And whether I'm at a party or at work, I'm always the first one to say, "Come sit with us." Do I love competition? I do. In fact, I hate losing more than I enjoy winning. But my objective is never to make someone feel like they're wrong for wanting to be part of a group. I think that's why my comedy is so inclusive. I want people to come to my shows and feel that someone understands them. But when someone does make unfounded assumptions about you right off the bat, it almost never has to do with anything you actually did. How could it? There was a club I didn't play for years because the booker decided she just didn't like whatever little she knew about me. Maybe she just didn't like me. Maybe she hated female comics. Who knows? But I couldn't change her mind. To be fair, we all do this kind of projecting, at least sometimes. When I was 16, a girl from Australia broke my best friend's heart, so for years, I hated Australians. Rather than realizing this was immensely ignorant, I thought I was ride or die. Loyalty to the point of stupidity should be plastered on my tombstone. P.S. Australians are not only the happiest, nicest people ever, they're also almost all hot. The worst, though,